This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. So as 2013 fades in our rearview mirrors and we bid it adios, let's chat about some of this year's biggest personal finance stories and what may lay ahead. Now, to do so, I've invited in the best and brightest around. Marketplace's DC reporter David Gura joins us. Hi, David.
Hey, Carmen. Thank you.
And Tara Siegel Bernard is here in the studio. She writes about personal finance and consumer issues for the New York Times. Welcome, Tara.
Thank you.
And David Lazarus is the consumer columnist for the LA Times. David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, David Lazarus, I'm going to start with you because, of course, this huge, giant beast of a story that was and is Obamacare. This has been quite the interesting year for it. How are we ending it?
Well, we're ending it with the healthcare.gov website ostensibly up and running. We'll see about that, although the administration is reporting that the numbers of signups are increasing, and it looks like a lot of the bumps in the road are out of the way. But you're right, Carmen, healthcare, probably the single biggest pocketbook story of the year for ordinary folks because the stakes are so large. We spend approximately $3 trillion every year on healthcare in this country. And per person, that's about twice what our colleagues in the developed world are spending overseas. There was a big story earlier this year. Steve Brill had just a terrific piece in Time magazine looking at the healthcare landscape and specifically hospital charges and how insane they are, not to put too fine a point on it. And I dwelled into that a bit myself, and I looked at drug prices, pharmacy prices, and in my reporting, I found that virtually all the major drugstore chains, and mostly CVS, were refilling people's prescriptions without their permission. CVS said, oh, no, we would never do that. But then I got my hands on emails from within the company saying that there are quotas, that there are ramifications for druggists if they don't get these things refilled. And all of this adds up to show how unlevel the playing field is and how hard it is for consumers to make informed decisions about the treatment they're seeking, about the drugs they're taking, when the entire system seems to be about reaching deeper into our pockets and walking away with as much pocket change as it can.
Yeah, and you know, what other thing do we spend money on where there are three plus different price levels depending on who you are and coverage you have and all of these things? So it's absolutely super confusing. And one thing, David, I wanted you to also talk about is you had this personally happen to you in terms of flu shots. And I think this is really interesting because I'm going to get mine this week.
And it's about time. You're a little late to the party, Carmen.
I know, I'm
Carmen.
So late. Yeah. I know I'm so late. Slap my hand. I know.
No wonder I've had sniffles for weeks now. You're to blame. Well, what was interesting here was I just went in for my routine flu shot. I went to a CVS in this case and was told that my insurance didn't cover it, which was a surprise because it had covered it at CVS in prior years. So I looked into it, and it turns out my insurance does indeed cover it. And then I wrote about it and started hearing from lots of other people, and apparently, there was an industry-wide thing going on this flu season, if not others, where virtually every major drugstore chain seemed to be telling people that they weren't covered for flu shots, thus requiring people to pony up the approximately $30 for the shot, full value there, and allowing the drugstore to, you know, to walk away with all that extra money.
Double dipping.
Indeed. And moreover, I mean, this is another sign, if it's indeed endemic in the industry, of how the system is working against us, because you go in for a flu shot, your time is valuable. Chances are you're not going to go out and come back some other time after checking with your insurer. You're going to say, all right, here's the $30. And they seem to be counting on that. Clearly, there's a problem in the system. One thing that contributes to this is the insurers, to some extent, on the one hand, might say a flu shot is a medical treatment. On the other hand, they might say it is a drug treatment, and they can't get their signal straight. The drugstores, in turn, are having a hard time figuring out what to make of it all. And again, the consumer is caught in the middle, not knowing what's going on.
Ah, what's new in that space? Looking forward, though, what does the year ahead look like, Tara?
We've heard from a variety of readers that had really mixed experiences. Some were able to get on no problem and were happy to learn that they'd be paying less. There's also plenty of people that wrote to me over the past, you know, month or two that had said, hey, you know, I'm actually going to be paying far more than I expected. And oftentimes those were younger, healthy people who are going to have to probably pay a little bit more to offset the fact that older people, sicker people, are only required to pay up to 3 times more than the general population. So there's going to be some give and take. You know, younger people may have to pay a little bit more. Older, sicker people may be paying a little bit less.
David Gurr, you have written a lot about the government shutdown. We're back in Washington again with the personal finance story. You know, this really cost the economy in general, but it cost Americans, too.
Yeah, absolutely. So this was probably one of the bigger stories on my beat this year. And, you know, if you look back at the last time we had government shutdowns in 95 and 96, we had estimates of how much they cost back then. They weren't the best estimates. And there it was about $1.5 billion, maybe $2.3 billion in today's dollars. The impact of this was much greater. And, you know, estimates, private estimates were between $20 and $24 billion to the whole economy. So those 16 days when the federal government was shut down really had a significant effect just, you know, on the whole economy and on consumers as well.
And, you know, in terms of the consumer spending, a lot of folks talk about, you know, GDP and is that really a good measure of the where things are going? But, you know, it seems to have affected consumer confidence, which does at times, not necessarily directly, but maybe a correlation, affects consumer spending, too. I mean, most Americans really get nervous when the parents are fighting.
Yeah, absolutely. And this couldn't have happened, I think, at a worse time. So this was at the beginning of October, sort of leading into the holiday season. And, you know, Washington has not done very much good to help consumer confidence over these last many months. This certainly was you know, a particularly low point. I think coupling with the fight here over the budget was a fight over the debt ceiling. That certainly gave consumers a lot more reason to be nervous as well. So, I don't think that we in Washington are doing anything good to make consumers more confident on what they're spending on.
Let's hope we get to a better point for 2014. And now, Tara, one big headline that you tracked this year and did a lot on was the Defense of Marriage Act and how it changes same-sex couples in terms of filing their taxes, because there are really some substantial changes for couples that can now get married.
Exactly. In fact, now, starting in 2013, couples are going to actually, they're going to have to file as married, either as married filed jointly or married filing separately. Mm-hmm. The demise of the Defense of Marriage Act will entitle these couples to a slew of federal benefits that their opposite sex peers took for granted, one of which may benefit them filing jointly or may not. If you are a married couple with a lower earning spouse or a stay-at-home spouse, you're actually probably going to get a nice refund. So take, for instance, one spouse, the working spouse, is earning $100,000 a year. The other spouse stays home with a child. You could save nearly $4,200 in federal taxes, which is
nice. That's big money.
Yeah, that is big money. Of course, on the other end, if you're a higher income couple or a couple that earns about the same amount of money, just because of the way the tax brackets line up, you could be paying far more. So you really have to run the numbers to see where you're going to come out. But TurboTax actually has a new calculator that will help you do that. And the reason why you want to check in with such a calculator or with your accountant is because you can refile your tax returns for the past 3 years. So if you're that, you know, couple making $100,000 entitled to a $4,200 return times three, that's significant savings.
That's buku bucks.
Yeah, yeah. So for 2010, 11, and 12, generally speaking, you can refile.
Retro.
Exactly.
And what about the financial services industry? You know, I mean, there's a lot of knowledge now about who the financial industry's providers are in terms of demographic, mm-hmm. and the new kind of rising demographic. So people of color, women as, you know, household, not only earners, but they manage the money. And now we have couples who can get married, all of a sudden this is a whole new industry in and of itself.
Right. But actually their situation should get easier to manage. There were a lot of financial planners that specialized in same-sex couples because there are so many, you know, specific rules depending on where you live. Do you live in a marriage state? Do you have children? Yeah. Do you live in a non-marriage state? So there are, you know, a lot of financial planners that do, and even now a lot of the firms that cater to high net worth folks of the world, Northern Trusts and whatnot, have special units that cater to these folks.
That's great. And you know what? Here's one favorite of mine that I'd love to talk about with you guys. The CFPB, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Listen, this is the first year that they're all together. They've got someone in charge. But so how have they been doing this year? I mean, they seem to be doing something, but how effective have they been this year?
Well, it seems please. As though they spent quite a bit of their time this year not just getting the enforcement thing rolling, but also marking territory, you know, mm-hmm. Marking the trees in the forest to lay
That's
down.
That's a great image.
Thank you very much. Well, it is Washington, and so I want to be apropos.
Fitting.
They're trying to basically establish the territory that they're going to be covering, and it is a wider purview than might have been imagined. I mean, they've been gradually going after other types of lenders, other types of financial institutions, other types of loans, and making it clear that they are taking their mandate of consumer financial protection very seriously. And I think it's to Richard Cordray's credit, now that he's in the captain's seat, that they are being so assertive in making it clear to all concerned that there's a new sheriff in town.
David Gore, what's your take on effectiveness here?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they're flexing their independence pretty well. And, you know, I was struck back in September. We had one of these J.P. Morgan settlements that they were party to. And that was, you know, demanding a refund of an estimated $300-something million to millions of customers that Chase had sort of engaged in malfeasance with. I think they'd charged cardholders for services that they weren't, in fact, getting. So, I agree with the other David that they're not just doing something. They're doing some things and really doing a whole lot from my vantage here.
Tara, let me ask you, you know, there was one big giant boo-boo in the CARD Act that the CFPB kind of fiddled with, which was the whole stay-at-home spouse, you know, that you couldn't get a credit card if you didn't have earned income.
Right.
So they've made some changes there, but that didn't give me a lot of confidence necessarily that the folks that are making these regulations that are supposedly protecting consumers actually know how American households are run. Because if you don't understand that someone who is earning the money and you have a stay-at-home spouse, that having access to credit
right.
is basically a lifeline
yep.
for many people.
Absolutely. I'm actually really interested to see how the CFPB weighs in on the big credit reporting bureaus.
Yes.
Because up until now, they really haven't been, you know, maybe lightly regulated by the FTC, if you could call it that, the Federal Trade Commission. But now they fall under their purview. So it's going to be really interesting because our credit reports are our lifelines to just about everything these days.
Yeah, I mean, if you know how these credit reports really work and if you're like us and you're digging in all this nerdy stuff, I actually live in complete and utter fear of what happens because a lot of us talk to and hear from folks who have their identity stolen or such and they have to work directly with the credit reporting bureaus. It can be a nightmare.
Oh, absolutely. You're expected to send everything in electronically and you're just waiting. And it's difficult just to find a 1-800 number to call to get a live person. And in most cases, you cannot. So it will be really interesting to see.
So for folks who are listening, if you live in fear, go to FTC.gov. They do have a whole like list that you can go through of the 1, 2, 3, 4, what to do if this happens to you. And I would just want to round it up with one last quick topic, if I can get your feedback on it. David Lazarus, I'll start with you. Income inequality. We are really talking about this. This is a pocketbook issue because we really are being limited in terms of having enough money to pay for everything.
Oh, it's a huge issue. And happily, Robert Reich called attention to it earlier this year with a really terrific documentary that highlights this. I mean, the haves have more than ever, and the have-nots are just scraping by with less and less. And we're seeing as the economy is recovering that there really isn't any sort of more equitable distribution of the nation's wealth. And that's not to be flying the Marxist-Leninist banner. That's just to simply say that if working stiffs don't have enough money to go out and buy things, then the haves at some point are going to find that the income isn't rolling upward in their direction like it used to be. So this is a major problem with enormous economic ramifications.
David Gura, help us out. You're in D.C. You got your ear to the ground. Give us some good news.
Yeah, I wish I could. I mean,
maybe?
I think that this, I think this is continuing to percolate. But yeah, David says go out and buy things. I mean, we got this report earlier this month from Harvard about just how much people are paying for rent. And, you know, that's going to continue hitting folks who are on the, let's say, the left end of that spectrum. So, I think I'm hearing more and more about income inequality here in Washington. And I can only hope that as 2014 goes along, it's going to come up more and more.
Tara, what do you think? Are things going to get better? Are we going to have some budging when it comes to income?
Well, you know, the only thing we can control is what we spend.
Right.
So that's, you know, people are just going to continue to focus on that. And that probably won't help the economy very much if we don't have enough to spend to keep it going. But that's, you know, everybody's concerned about the economy, but it starts at home. People are concerned about their own personal economies.
So. Exactly. That's where it is, and that's where the struggle is. Well, you know, guys, I hope that 14 is a much luckier number for the future. Tara Siegel-Bernard is a consumer issues reporter with the New York Times. David Lazarus is the LA Times consumer columnist. And marketplace reporter David Gura is based in D.C. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.